This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 269 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part and completes our Drums of Autumn read-along. This episode is sponsored by Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy. They are a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers to invest for the first time with true confidence. Robinhood is simple and has intuitive, clear design with data presented in an easy-to-digest way.
The Robinhood web platform also lets you view your stock collections. They have collections like 100 most popular, sectors like entertainment and social media, and curated categories like female CEOs, and analyst ratings of buy, hold, sell for every stock.
Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up at outlander.robinhood.com. That's outlander.robinhood.com.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, as Ginger stated earlier, concludes the Drums of Autumn read-along. Clearing the way for season four next week. I don't know if I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm not ready. I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm ready. I think I'm ready. Okay. So, Ginger, are you ready?
I don't think we have a choice, so doesn't really matter if I'm ready or not.
Okay, then.
I'm excited to see the show. I don't know that I'm ready for the hecticity. That is the season.
All right. This week, we will begin the conclusion of our Drums of Autumn read-along with chapter 65 entitled Return to Fraser's Ridge. I don't know why I'm having a hard time saying that tonight.
try it again.
Return to Fraser's Ridge.
There you go. They are on their way back to the ridge from River Run. Lord John went with them a bit before turning toward Virginia. Martina P. writes, "The farewell wishes between Lord John and the Frasers are very sweet. Claire seems surprised to be embraced as well, and it is just precious that he trusts Claire to take good care of the three redheads. I enjoy when Claire tells us that Jamie wouldn't want to be separated from his new grandson, and that while we don't know who the father might be, there is no doubt who his grandsire is."
Real quick, I wanted to point out that last week I made a very big stink about not knowing where Willie was, and Willie is in Virginia.
That is true.
So we know now. And some people maybe already knew.
Marlo R. writes, "Lord John and Claire's friendship continues to grow as Lord John hands over his watching over them duties to Claire just before heading back to Virginia and Willie. It seems the bond of friendship between Lord John and Claire is almost complete. The jealousy is subsiding, and they now have a trust between each other that is built on the mutual love for the same people." So a week later, and they'd arrived. The place is bare and bleak, but it is beautiful. They are home. Martina P. writes, "I love Diana's description of the desolate state of Fraser's Ridge, and despite it all, Claire is filled with utter joy to be home. It seems to be the same sense of happiness she always felt when returning to Lallybroch. I have a special fondness of the chapters when we get a glimpse of Jamie and Claire's peaceful domesticity, allowing them to relax with affection and appreciation for each other. The conversation about the baby's birth certificate is very sweet, and I applaud Bree for patiently waiting for Roger to arrive to give the baby a proper name." So that's a tiny bit ahead. So Claire is making out the birth certificate for the baby. We find out that the baby is a redhead. Brianna, however, refuses to give him a formal name yet.
So what is she planning on doing with this birth certificate? Like, is she going to send it to the census or like the county? I'm like, because usually they keep track of these things in like the family Bible.
Sure. They'll probably add it to the family Bible.
Do they have a family Bible?
The reason she's doing it is because she was the doctor who attended the birth.
Gotcha.
But otherwise, I don't know where they would have gotten it. She still may have actually, I don't know, knowing Claire as Claire, even if she weren't a healer, she still may have tried to.
So is she putting
have it, Jamie write one
is she
out.
Putting it like in her doctor journal?
I think a certificate is something you should be able to take around by itself. So I don't think it's, I mean, it might be slipped in, but I don't think it's like a bound page or anything. That's my guess. So Claire says to Jamie that Brianna trusts Roger. Jamie says there's a difference between trust and hope. So for now, they call him, or she calls him, little query mark. And as is not uncommon with young babies, he is keeping everyone in the house awake at night. Jamie says he would hope, if he could decide, to hope that Roger would come or hope that Roger wouldn't come back. And then when we get a new name, Claire has christened the baby. She calls him Gizmo, and that is what I stick with the rest of the chapter. Actually, most of the chapters until we get a name. So now she's calling him, or she calls him at least once, Gizmo. She then tells Jamie about Saint Fariolus, if that's the right pronunciation, the patron saint of sick poultry, and a martyr. But they have no idea what his martyrdom has to do with chickens. Jamie mentions a Saint Guignol who is invoked against impotence. Huh. We always learn something from Diana. So one of the pieces of information that she does have for the birth certificate is the mother's name. She writes, Brianna Ellen. And then she asks Jamie, should it be Randall or Fraser? It might matter. Now, this is a very touching conversation. Jamie is still trying to work on the forgiveness he's received from Brianna. He's like, I don't know. She may not want to be a Fraser after what I did. And Jamie says, though, just in case, you know, use both names. And Claire kind of wraps up their conversation by saying, Roger will come. And then kind of under her breath, I hope.
With a nickname like Gizmo, I think it should not be fed after midnight. And the concern that I had with that made me go off on another tangent because I started thinking about the gremlins a little bit and I was like, but isn't it always after midnight? When can you start feeding them again?
That's true. Don't think that hard.
And then
summer.
You started talking about the saint of impotence. He was talking about the statue and they're all like hammering off little pieces of it and keeping it in their pocket. I thought that was a funny little anecdotal thing. Which probably really happened. I'm assuming she got it from someplace. But I mean, I'm imagining it's like a little worry stone that they carry around with them and like rub on it for good luck.
Here, just rub on this cock part.
Well, they didn't even chisel the cock part. Didn't they chisel everything but the cock part?
I thought it was the cock part because
he said it never,
exactly. Miraculously, it never shrank.
No.
Marlo R. writes, Bree shouldn't have to choose between her fathers. She should be able to have both. Frank tried to be a good father and knowingly raised a child that was not his own. He took on this responsibility and did his best. This is the same responsibility that they are going to ask Roger to take on if he returns to raise a child that might not be his own. So while I understand Jamie being so upset when it comes to Brianna, I would like him to have more understanding. Because if Roger decides to come back and take the responsibility, he is going to expect this child to see Roger as his father and love him no matter what. So how is that different from Brianna loving Frank?
I don't know.
I think the materially, it's not. But because Jamie never had to come face to face with Frank, Jamie had no, he had a choice, but he made the right one about sending Claire back to protect the baby. And of course herself. but he made that very selfless choice. And as a result of that, lost the woman he loved and at that point his only child to, well, he was supposed to die, so that part didn't really matter at that time, but lost them willingly to someone who was basically, you know, a rival-ish. Not really, but, you know, someone else on the other side. So I don't think there's any difference materially, but the difference is that Jamie didn't have to be around Frank and Brianna in that situation. He does have to be around Roger and Gizmo in this situation. And even though it was all done for them, for Brianna, as Roger later admits, not in this chapter, maybe two chapters from now, he admits that he apologizes. He admits full on that he should not have left her. So he knows he's part of it. He is not a reason for her rape. It's not his fault. But he knows that his mistake was leaving her. So Jamie has, there's a lot of baggage that Jamie has right now wrapped into this. And he definitely blames himself for the whole, you know, misunderstanding of thinking of him as the rapist. He's sorry for that. He's not sorry, I don't think, for being pissed off and probably not even hurting him a little bit or a lot for him leaving her. Although when he beat him up, it was because of the rape and taking advantage of her, supposedly rape. It wasn't because he left her. At that point, that was like the least of anything. So anyway, that's my opinion. Someone's coming. I don't know who he is, but he is gonna be great. Roger is on his way. Diana gives us a peek at him. He had bathed the night before to make himself as presentable as possible, as you do, but he's still he's still totally rough and he's still limping. He's still got the bushy going on, and he comes to the clearing where he'd first met Jamie Fraser. And the chapter ends with, quote, "Nothing mattered now save the fact that he was here," unquote. And Martina P. writes, "Roger is on his way to the ridge, and one cannot help to feel for the poor guy when he reaches the clearing where he first met Jamie, and the tragedy that followed. His foot is still not healed, and I, for one, am filled with sympathy and cannot wait for Claire to deal with his injured foot already."
You say tragedy, I say adventure.
And I say tragedy too, but I that was her words. I say drama.
Well, I say conflict. And no story is a good story without conflict.
Totally.
Moving right along, that was chapter 65. Moving on to chapter 66, entitled Child of My Blood.
Claire is in her garden. She is thinking of Ian and Rollo, and the people, the animals that she, you know, missed. And she's planting some of the cuttings that she'd brought with them from River Run. She would have to keep these darn rabbits away. They went through and ate a lot of the cabbage and destroyed some stuff. She was going to have Jamie tinkle around the garden to keep the pests out.
He was going to mark it. He was going to claim that garden.
Exactly.
For his carnivore self.
He was the closest thing they had to a raging carnivore. Scary raging carnivore.
You would not have survived, Ginger.
Oh, I would have, because I'd be eating eggs. I would have eaten ham.
You would not have survived because you are a vegetarian and you do not have the correct pee to be able to ward off the rabbits from your garden.
That has nothing to do with anything, because she used Jamie.
Yeah, but
she used Jamie. She didn't use her.
Of course she didn't, but she had a Jamie. So if you didn't have a carnivore husband or a carnivore male in the vicinity, you would have the wrong pee. I'm saying you would not be able to protect your own garden.
I have cats and cat litter. I would sprinkle the cat litter. That's nasty enough.
I would not want to eat anything growing around your garden.
Summer, you keep it around the edges. You don't throw it on the plants. B, B,
C, C D.
Yeah. F, are not U. In order. I don't care. Lorraine B. writes, "This chapter opens benignly enough, vegetable ravishment by rabbits and assorted animals notwithstanding. I had no idea what maypop fruit was, so I've included a link. A passion fruit that grows in North America and is green as opposed to its bright orange-colored tropical cousin. I realize now that I was served a maypop and passion fruit-topped dessert at a Christmas dinner not too long ago. It was delicious. Claire is concerned about protecting her precious garden, and rightly so. little or no preserved food for the winter could spell sickness or death. And she gives us a link that I will share in the show notes all about Maypop. Eileen P. writes, rabbits, thwarting gardeners throughout the centuries. I can just hear Peter Rabbit saying, hey, what's that ginger doing? Peeing? That's just gross. Peter gags a bit, then leaps over the urine. He quickly throws vegetables over the urine barrier to Mopsy, Flopsy, and Cottontail, and Benjamin Bunny. Claire will have to plant a new crop. Man, I'm so glad bunnies are not that adventurous. Claire sees movement at the edge of the clearing. And of course, it's Roger. He's glad that it's her that he's met first. He asks first about the baby and Brianna. She tells him that he has a son. And he's startled. I think that her statement is one of confirmation of his worries and wonderings. As in, he knows she's pregnant. He knows the son. He knows the child should be born by now. But the big question, the reason that he had to decide to come back or stay was not because she was pregnant. It was because the baby might not be his. Hold on. Because remember, when they told him that she was pregnant, he was shocked, but his face kind of lit up. But it wasn't until he learned about the rape that he was like, oh, I got to think about this. So for her to say, you have a son, he's thinking, oh my gosh, this is confirmation. And she's like, simmer down now. She says, you're here, aren't you? And he says, I'm here. When he steps inside and they go into the cabin, it's kind of funny. I'm sorry. Jamie pushes Brianna onto the floor and grabs for his pistols and then says, oh, it's you. And then the baby, of course, starts to shriek. It had been even longer since Bree had seen him, Roger, than it had been for Jamie and Claire. Jamie stands by Brianna. And Claire sees the Mackenzie resemblance in him and Roger, the way they stand and their stillness. Roger reaches toward Jamie and says, as his nearest kinsman, he is the one to cut him. He's there to swear a blood oath. After Jamie has cut him, Roger swipes his thumb across his wrist and then smears his blood on the baby's forehead and claims him as his own. Lorraine B. writes, the question I have is, why is there no mention of Jamie's blood or his being cut? It doesn't seem like there was any blood shared. Now, if I read correctly, Lorraine, their shared blood was the Mackenzie blood, right, Sam?
Between who and who?
Jamie and Roger.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay. Eileen P. writes, well, actually,
I was like, there's a lot of shared blood in that cabin right now. Like, narrow it down
there's
for
a
me.
Lot. That's true. Eileen P. writes, of course Roger claimed Brianna's son as his own. However, I really wasn't expecting Roger to swear a blood oath. It's not the type of thing Roger would have done in the 1960s. I think he's using his understanding of history and Highland culture to help him win over Jamie. That blood oath was for Jamie's benefit, not Brianna's. Also, Roger was very brave to let Jamie cut him. That's a lot of trust. That is true.
Well, I mean,
that's braver than doing the blood oath.
Come on now. He's already done it, right?
Oh, man. Done what?
Jamie has already shed his blood. He cannot do any worse than he already has.
Well, by slicing his wrist open and letting him bleed to death, sure he can.
He wouldn't do that in front of Claire and Brianna. Come on.
That's all Eileen is saying. That's all she's saying. It's a lot of trust. After the way he's been treated, it's a lot of freaking trust. I don't disagree.
I think he's literally in the safest room to let Jamie come at him with a knife. He's got a skilled surgeon.
That's true. And a lot of witnesses.
And Brianna. And he's not going to kill Brianna's
baby daddy.
Erstwhile hand-fasted baby, maybe daddy.
Maybe baby daddy.
Right.
What's better? Baby, maybe daddy or maybe baby daddy? They both rhyme.
Say maybe daddy. They said that on This Is Us last night.
Which one?
Maybe daddy.
Oh, they didn't say all three.
Well, no, it was just maybe daddy and maybe mama.
Try that again, Summer, three times. And then
I can't.
Sorry, go ahead.
Point being, that is the safest place to let Jamie come at him with a knife.
And then Roger asks her if she is his wife. And her answer is, I don't know. Eileen P. writes, Brianna has always been hesitant with Roger. The relationship has been a slow build with Brianna constantly protecting herself. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Eileen means not just since the rape. She means like since they met, period. She talks about a marriage. Eileen continues. She talks about a marriage of love versus a marriage of obligation when it's clear Roger loves her. He has always loved her. Look at the actions, Brianna. He hiked through the wilderness after being enslaved by Mohawks. He gave up going through the stones, came to the ridge, and claimed his son because he loves you. Stop being so afraid. What do you think about that, Sam?
I mean, we get into that in a chat in one or two chapters down the line. There's a lot. Him coming is
the easier part.
It answers one question, yes. But it doesn't answer a bunch of other ones because, yes, he came back, but. You know, and especially since the first thing he did was claim the child, right? So did he come back out of obligation? Did he come back? Did he come back because he just felt guilty? Did he come back because he wants to be with her? There's so many facets to what could be going through her mind at this moment that, I mean, and she hasn't seen him in how long? And the last time she saw him, they were fighting? So, I mean... there's a lot. And in the interim, her dad beat him up, sold him to the Indians, and then basically said, come back or don't.
Technically, he donated him.
Okay, fine. He gifted him to the Iroquois.
There you go. Jamie mentions the hand fasting, and Roger says, yep, they're still hand fasting. It's only mid-June. Did I say that? It's only mid-June. And they're hand fast till September 2nd, I think he said. 2nd or 3rd? 2nd. Jamie gives Brianna some tough love. Look, if you're handfast, then he is your husband. And then she brings up, but what if the baby? It may not be yours. Oh, Brianna, hush, dude, hush. And then he says, oh, but he is mine. Mm? He admits his fault that he should have. This is where I was talking about earlier. He admits his fault. He apologizes. He should have stayed with her. So then she asks the question that she's been wanting to ask since she was back with John, Lord John. She wants to know why he came back. He says he came back because he wanted to and because he thought he should. He did go back to the stones, he admits, and it took a long time to find them. He returns. As he's saying this, he puts down the opal on the table. And Bree says she doesn't want him to stay out of duty.
I would like him to stay out of duty. I think everyone should stay out of duty.
Claire realizes that Brianna was speaking of her and Frank regarding the type of marriage that she won't settle for. Jamie says that for now, they're still wed as it's mid-June. They'll live together as man and wife until the 3rd. That's a year and a day. Well, the 3rd of September. And then she'll decide. But he warns Roger, if you touch her unwilling, I'll cut out your heart. Now, he doesn't really touch him, but he like moves the knife away from him and like puts it in the table. And he's like, step off, dude. He goes outside. And then Jamie follows him. And he says to him, you think I'd trouble a woman who didn't want me? And then walks out. Jamie follows him. And there's a scuffle. And Claire calls it testosterone poisoning. So in a way, not that Roger, I think there was something in an earlier book that said, you know, Roger had, he'd probably been in some scuffles or bar fights or something, you know, that a young man in Scotland may have been in. He's done something. He's been in situations where he's had to protect himself. Not a ton, but he's not a fighter per se, but he's had to protect himself a little bit, but not too often. It's not a regular occurrence. And that, in tandem with him being a scholar and an artist, a musician, he's a lover, not a fighter. And I say that with love of Roger, for love of Roger. One,
I look forward to learning that about him.
Right? One thing that Roger has had to learn the hard way is, I don't think he's shied from it. He knew this, and he wasn't afraid to be physical when needed. When he got on the Gloriana, he had to toughen up Buttercup because, you know, his hands and the blisters and you know, and the hard work. He could do it. It just, he was not accustomed to it. Just like that, he can fight. I mean, it's 2-on-1 is no fair. So Jamie and Ian, that was just not nice. But he had it in him to step up. He had it in him, but he has never had to step up in the ways he has had to step up for the past year or more since going through the stones. So one of the things I am glad for is, I'm not glad for violence. That's not it. But I'm glad to see Roger, 18th century Roger, not 20th century Roger. I never thought of him as a pansy, ever, or a wuss. But I am glad to see him giving Jamie as good as he gets. It's like, step off. Roger's growing up a little bit, and I'm happy for that.
Okay, two things. Uh-huh. One, when you said he's shied from it, what I heard was he's shite from it.
No, and you I was have, like, wait, you huh? You have poo on the brain. Right, you stop.
I do. And then it's good. I think you need to know that if the most powerful stance that you can come up with is step off, you and I need to work on on look, your power phrases.
I'm not a fighter.
Clearly.
I'm a lover. Maybe not physically. for long days. Well, we're not going to get into
Mike,
my
why are you airing but. That? Nobody asked.
You hush. What was I going to say?
Step no, off.
That's
all. Okay. I'm going to do that from now on. Anytime you take me off, I'm going to put one hand on my hip and I'm going to say, Ginger, step off.
You stop. That hurt. Oh, man. Wow. And Claire calls this testosterone poisoning. Lorraine B. writes, I like the fact that there is friction between Jamie and Roger. They have a basic understanding of each other. Both are sworn to protect the women that they love. From here on in, it will be a treat to see how or if they can resolve this friction. Eileen P. writes, is testosterone poisoning really a thing or is Claire making it up? It's like two bucks fighting, but with cursing and threats. I don't think it's a thing. I think she was being facetious, but more sarcastic, whatever. Diana writes, quote, life on the mountain was a trifle tense, unquote.
A little bit.
And the only part of this paragraph that I want to focus is on, and Summer, this is all, this is all in caps, and this is done for Summer. Are you ready, Summer? This is all for you.
I'm ready.
It's no singing involved, I promise.
Thank you.
Diana writes, life on the mountain was a trifle tense. And the only part of this paragraph that I even care about, that I want to focus on, is, in all caps, Lizzie falling over her feet to apologize to everyone in sight. Mm-hmm. As you should, girl.
Right?
Whoa. I just did that because this is for you. So now clear it out, girl. You could bring it back. I'm not telling you you can't. But this is your time to, like, get it all out. What up? What up with Lizzie?
Well, I'm just, what? I mean, it's the only time that she's ever going to be believed for apologizing. You know what I mean? This is the only appropriate time for her to have this talk. And then she needs to let it go. And everyone does. But it's like, I don't know. Clearly everyone forgives her and we all move forward. But good God, that girl.
Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They achieve this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs.
Now, Summer and I love to talk about the delicious meals, some of the delicious meals we get, and this week is no different. I am looking forward to the Indian-style cauliflower over curry rice. Remember, half a pod's a vegetarian, half of pod eats all the meat.
I am personally, I don't know what I'm looking more forward to this week. My box is showing up on Friday, and I have steak fajitas with onions, peppers, and cheesy rice, which is exciting because it says it's ready in 25 minutes. Who can be mad about that? Or if I'm more excited about the turkey mozzarella and pesto paninis, because I love pesto, and that comes with roasted broccoli.
So how does Blue Apron work? You choose from chef-designed recipes. We, Blue Apron, deliver fresh, seasonally inspired ingredients. And you cook incredible meals in as little as 20 minutes.
Blue Apron offers a range of recipes bursting with flavor. Whether you're looking for quick and easy meals or a full culinary cooking experience, Blue Apron lets you choose from a range of recipe options.
So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/outlander. That's blueapron.com/outlander to get your first three meals free.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
So the baby had colic and kept everyone up at night. What better motivation do you need to build a house where the baby can stay away from you? Some of the tenants had planted some corn for them so they'd be able to eat that winter. Thank goodness.
And to put some sound buffer up in between their houses and the baby.
So Jamie had some time to, he didn't have to dedicate to too much to planting. He was able to go continue work on building the new cabin. Claire demands to take, finally demands, like, look, I am going to take care of that foot, Roger. She has him lie down, and when she discovers that she'll need to debride the wound and break them open to drain the abscesses, she asks Brianna for help. Lizzie jumps up to volunteer. Step off, Lizzie, and sit down, biznatch. Claire tells her to take the baby away. You can help me that way. Bree, instead, sits at his head and holds his hands. This is not only a necessary medical procedure, yes, but it's also a genius way to force the two of them, or give them an opportunity, force, whatever, to be physically close in a non-romantic way. So it's a pressure-off way for them to be touching and be somewhat intimate in this situation. Bree holds him tight as Claire goes to work. She's ready to add maggots into the wound to eat away at the dead flesh. Fun times.
I thought it was funny in listening to Davina read this chapter to me, as I like to think she does. It's just for me. She pronounced debridement as French.
Mm. Debridement?
Yeah, it was jarring because...
That is interesting. I've never heard it
pronounced like that. I've always heard it, you know, debriding, debridement, you know, and it was like debridement. I was like, oh, what was that? What was that?
You're like, oh, okay, that woke me up.
Well, because I started to think, what was that? What I heard? Is that the word she used? Because it was a new word to me.
Claire goes out. Jamie has Gizmo. Lizzie had gone outside with the baby, of course, as Claire had asked her to, and Lizzie started to cry. So Jamie sent her away and he took the baby. Lizzie, we find out, is grieving Ian. Jamie asks how Roger and Bree are getting on. Claire says that they're getting used to each other again because he's just thrown up in her lap. How romantical. Totes. Lorraine B. writes, this also ties into the overall theme of the last section of the book. Je t'aime. I love you. Claire both protects the child of her blood and shows her love of Brianna by getting her to help Roger ride out the pain while Claire sees to his infected foot. And with the usual gabaldon ick factor, I have learned far more about maggots than I thought I ever would. I am not a squeamish person when it comes to insects or snakes. I routinely put wayward spiders out my door and have kept a garter snake for part of a summer while my kids learned all about it. But there's something about opening up my green box, or food scraps collected for compost, and finding a bunch of wriggling maggots that creep me out. I'm sure I would welcome the critters to help me heal if I had to. Kudos to Roger for not freaking out. Yum.
What choice did he have? He understood that this was the closest he was going to get to this was modern medicine for the time period.
It was.
You know, this is just what you get.
Eileen P. writes, here's a wee bit about maggots and wound care from livescience.com. Thanks, Eileen. And yes, we'll share all these links in the show notes. Quote, maggots secrete an enzyme that dissolves dead tissue but leaves healthy tissue alone, Kirstner said. Although there are a few risks to the treatment, quote, there is a gross factor to it. Kushner said, patients have to be very psychologically strong. Future research should determine whether the effects of maggot therapy. Did you hear that? Maggot therapy can be improved using more maggots, and whether an increase in the number of critters would be painful, the researchers said. Oh, no. And then she says, stop gagging. That scene is not about Claire using maggots to treat his wound. It's about Claire putting maggots in Roger's foot to make Brianna hold him close. Smooth move, Claire.
Well, I feel like she'd said, you know, further research needs to be done to know if it was more maggots. But I think that you would need to know if you did enough maggots, because they only last for a few days. And if they haven't debrided the entire area, then you aren't done. And then you have to go put more maggots in. And more maggots might get the job done faster. Then less. I don't know. And next, chapter 67, entitled The Toss of a Coin.
Erica B. writes, with the title of the chapter, I am assuming we'll be presented with some sort of gamble where a bit of luck is required. We shall see. So Roger is being kept in the new surgery at the big house. So this is what I meant about Jamie continuing to build the big house. So when they first moved to the ridge and built the cabin, that is not the big house, right? That's the cabin. That's the first cabin. And that's what Jamie and Claire and Brianna were living in, and the baby now. So once Roger comes, actually, even before Roger got there, probably once, but especially once he got there, it was like, yeah, we need to do this. So he continued his work on the big house, and having had some of his tenants plant for them, it allows him to spend more time building.
I know, but think about it. When they got there, they built the cabin. It was just him and Claire, right? So yes. Plenty of room.
Well, and Ian.
Huh?
And Ian, young Ian.
Right, but still. Plenty of room because it wasn't the lean-to that they were in before when the three of them were living under a tent thing on the edge of whatever. So they built the cabin, plenty of room for the people that they had at hand at that time. Then here comes Brianna. So now they've got four people plus her little Lizzie. So that's five people in a cabin. So then, you know, they lose Ian, but they gain a really loud baby. So, I mean, they've been steady at like, five people in a cabin that was really meant for like two or three. So they are
two and a half.
So they were like, okay, this has become super priority to get the big house done because we are not going to make it because that baby's just going to get bigger.
So Roger, so one of the things that I don't know if it was on purpose, definitely was not on purpose for Roger, I don't think, because he just got there. But it may have been on purpose for Claire. And that is Jamie, they have the frame and some of the roof on, I think. But Jamie works hard to get the surgery at least filled out, walls up, whatever, the floor in. He works hard to get the surgery at least up, far enough along so that someone can sleep on a table within it. So the windows, we learn, aren't done because it's still summer, so they don't need them, but they will be getting glass. So Roger's being kept in the new surgery at the big house. Bree comes there to chat with him, and sometimes with the baby, sometimes without the baby. And he does resent the wee boy a bit. Not for his own sake, but because it affects his time with his mom. She'd brought with her this time a meal, and he is ravenous. Once she leaves, he's eating it all. He's healing, but, quote, the trouble with being restored to health was that some parts of him were getting a damn sight too healthy for comfort. given the chance of their having any proper exercise was something below nil, unquote.
But can we talk about, I was thinking about it when I was listening to the book earlier today about how he's staying in what's going to be the bigger house, and there's no windows yet, but they don't need them because the season hasn't turned yet, so it's still warm, which is the only place I would let a dude with maggots in his feet hang out. Because
I don't know why that made me laugh. That's disgusting.
Because wait for it. Because as the maggots...
I don't want to wait for it. That's disgusting.
As the maggots, what do they pupate? Is that what they call it? When they turn into flies?
Oh my God, stop!
When they turn into flies, I don't want them.
They can fly out?
Yes, they can fly out the windows. So they're not trapped in the cabin, because I hate nothing more than having a fly trapped in a house with me. It's one of my least favorite things ever. So that was some, I don't know if it was on purpose, but that was some amazing forethought and planning.
I know what was on purpose. You sharing that.
You're welcome.
Ugh. Well, as he's there on his own, eating and finishing his lunch, after he has some time to think about it, he knew that he'd returned for love of her. He returned because he couldn't live without her on the other side. Erica B. writes, I find it odd that Roger came all this way and went through all kinds of hardship just to sit at the stones, not knowing what he was going to do. I can fully understand being upset with Jamie, but to even hesitate about Bree, I find baffling. Granted, I was not the one away from the person I loved for nearly a year. Claire comes to clear him. She comes to check him out one more time, and she clears him for walking. She says that Jamie has the back bedroom in the house nearly floored, so the two of them, Jamie and Claire, will be moving into the big house shortly, and that will give Brianna and him and the baby some room.
Y'all gonna have to figure it out because we're taking our house back.
This is well, not even back. We're taking this is it'll be ready. No one's taken it yet except for him. Well, I guess back from him. But he was placed there, so it wasn't like he wanted to take it over. Roger mentions to Claire the Brianna issue. She says, well, you were her first, right? And then her entire experience with sex or anything relating to it is being deflowered, being raped 2 days later, and then giving birth. That's kind of not a fun thing.
That's not a happy hole.
No. Oh, my God. Bree is afraid that she won't be able to, let's get it on. That was really low, and I should never do that again. But you know what I'm trying to say. She tells him, just be careful. And then Jamie comes, bringing him a razor and some hot water. Now, that's another clue. Take care of yourself, man. Granted, he hadn't had a chance out there in the wilderness. No one's knocking him for that. But they're like, okay, we're about to go away and leave them a little time. And pretty soon, we're going to have the big house back. So these two, even if they're not knocking boots, they need to be at least friendly and be able to share the same place because they're going to have it. So get rid of that damn, get rid of the bush.
Put your best face forward, Roger.
Get rid of the damn bush.
The shrubbery.
He brings him razor and a hot water.
Shave a razor and a haircut. And hot water. Two bits.
That's another clue. Take care of yourself, man. Jamie stayed while he shaved. Now, that is a little disconcerting. I was like, let me watch you.
Maybe he wants his razor back. Maybe he doesn't trust him to not slit his own wrist.
Oh, Summer. He's like, no, I am going to. You need to take care of that baby and that girl. I love her, but I need my wife back.
Right?
You will not get out of this alive or dead. He confirms that he and Claire will be staying there that night. Roger says to just tell them which chores he can take over. Because he went through a few things and he's like, nope, can't do that. Nope, nope, nope. But he's like, look, I have a strong back. I can do this. And Jamie's like, yep, that'll do. And first up, Claire's garden needs spading. And then he tells him that he and Claire are going to go to Marsali's that evening. And conveniently, they're leaving Bree with the Baron. Huh. Eileen P. writes, I love how Jamie and Claire are trying to help Roger and Brianna get back together. They arranged time, alone time for them in the cabin. Very sweet. Well, the baby will be there too. Hopefully there will be some family bonding. Jamie and Roger finally finished the conversation that they had begun when they went to rescue Roger. Quote, you've cost me a lad I loved, and I'm no inclined to like you for it, but I maybe cost you more than that. I'll call the score settled or not at your word. And Roger says, done. Erica B. writes, as Jamie handed over the basin, there was a small metallic clink and a red spark glowed against the pewter. Two things, Erica says. What was dropped in the bowl or caused the clink? In the next paragraph, Jamie blames Roger for losing Ian. It's like he forgot how Roger got into the circumstance in the first place. To blame him for it is not cool, even though he doesn't hold it against him in the end. Okay, what made the clink is a flash of red spark. We find that out, I think, two or three chapters later. But can you say what it is, Sam?
Do you want me to say what it was?
Yeah.
It's his ring with the ruby.
Mm-hmm.
The ruby ring.
The second thing, Erica, yeah, that's kind of, isn't that what I was saying? Maybe not.
I'm just going to say that Jamie's not allowed to bring up Ian like that ever again. Because that's just like, you know what I mean? That's just, everybody knows what happened and what went down. And frankly, we don't know.
It was his freaking fault.
Right. And we don't.
Well, actually, it was Lizzie's fault, but.
Still. Well, it was Lizzie's fault, but. It was also Jamie's fault, and mostly it was Ian's fault because Ian put himself into that position willingly.
That's true.
So, and we don't even know who killed the person in the skirmish that required them to replace a member of the Mohawk tribe at all. You know what I mean? So that's never been fully fleshed out. In my gut, I feel like perhaps it was Roger because he poked that dude with a stick that was sharpened on one end, and that may indeed have killed him.
I do think, okay, I said I don't know who it is. We don't know for sure. Like, it hasn't been confirmed, but I do believe it was Roger.
Right. So, but that alone, he would not have been put into that situation had Jamie and Ian not given him to the Iroquois, had Jamie and Ian not kicked his ass, had Lizzie not lied and told them that Roger raped.
Well, it wasn't a lie, but she spread a rumor. Yes.
Okay. Point being, she should have kept her mouth shut and minded her own business. So all of these things happened, and very few of them were in Roger's, in his, what's the word I'm looking for? It doesn't matter. Very few of those things were within Roger's control. So to blame him losing Ian on Roger is kind of a move. So like I said, you said it, you got it out of your system, but you can't say that anymore.
That's basta, no more. Eileen P. writes, I like that Jamie finally admitted to Roger that he cost him a lot. Jamie can be stubborn, but his honor will shine through. Now, does it? What do you think about that? So Eileen is glad that that he mentioned it to. I don't know how to take that. Not from Eileen. I mean, from Jamie. Is it because, like you said, like, look, I'm going to say it one more time. I you're here for Brianna. You better treat her nice. All that, which is true, which we all want him to treat Brianna nicely. And he will, or treat her well. But he's like, look, I did a lot, you know. It's like when he's saying he's forgetting that he freak Lizzie aside. He's not even including the part of the equation that got Roger's ass with the mohawk. And then he has the audacity to say, I spent a lot of money and lost people. Because the whiskey was their money. That was all the money they would have in a year. Remember that? I spent money. Basically money. And I lost my his only kinsman there. Well, besides Jocasta, his only kin's man. I lost freaking a lot and I can't get it back. Don't you forget that. I was like, you're right. That's a total move. So I really honestly, I'm glad. I hope they don't bring it up again. But I'm kind of stuck on that too. I don't know. Eileen really likes the fact that Jamie admitted to Roger that it cost him a lot.
Hey, we are all entitled to our own opinions.
Oh, of course. I'm just saying, is that an admission or is that like a look you?
I don't know. I feel like maybe he's just telling him, you know, there's been a lot of sacrifices for you to have this.
Yeah, so don't mess it up.
Right. But still, don't bring up Ian again.
Oh, gosh.
Not like that.
Later, Roger goes to the cabin. He's having a hard time deciding to enter or not. He like, I'm sorry, Roger, that... Just as Jamie was kind of being a D, here you're being a C. And by C, I mean creeper. You don't walk around like that when Brianna knows her parents. You know that Brianna knows her parents are gone and you're in the middle of nowhere. You don't do that. That's not cool. And he's going to go in, but then he sees that Brianna comes out headed toward the privy and he startles her. You have to respect someone trying to take care of their necessary. He gently forces the issue. It's like, don't. If I'm heading to the bathroom, that is not the time to like try and corner me. She said, I got to do this. You wait till she comes out and then you talk. Or did he? Did I misread that? Did he let her go?
Okay. So this is what happens. He follows her. He's following her. And he doesn't stop her. He's just following her. So she says, what's the matter with you sneaking up on me like that? She demanded furiously. I want to talk to you. She didn't answer, but whipped around and made off down the path, you know, because she's got to pee. I said, I want to talk to you, he repeated more loudly following her. And she said, I want to go to the bathroom. She said, go away. She shut the door of the privy with a decisive slam. Yeah, I don't want somebody following me into the bathroom. She's not saying I'm not going to talk to you.
Exactly.
You can calm down and let her pee.
That's what I'm saying. Man. So, but he gently forces the issue. Should he go to bed up the hill or in the cabin? They get to brass tacks here outside the privy. He finally tells her he could not go and live without her. Meaning, of course, go through the stones, go back to the future. They have a chat. She says, no, she wouldn't waste their time right then. He says, look, this is our time. I understand you may be scared. Don't waste this. This is our time. We had time before, but you wanted to come. He didn't say this. This is me making this up or putting the words in there. Their time has pretty much been since Claire has left. But understandably, she wanted to finish school. She wanted to come see. All the things that they did brought them here, obviously. But now especially now that they're together with her family, now hopefully his family, and they have a child and they are a family of their own. This is their, if there ever was a time that is theirs, it is freaking their time now. And he's like, we can't waste this. Whatever this is, we'll break through it, but don't waste our time. Don't, you know, don't ignore me. Don't avoid me. That's wasting our time. That's wasting our time. And he understands that she's scared, but she says that no, she won't waste. I won't waste any more time. And she's given her answer just as he has given his. And the baby cries and she rushes back in, of course, but not before inviting him in. Back inside, she's nursing the baby and she's understandably a little self-conscious. And he says, look, fair's fair. Because she has her shift, I think, down to the waist. And one breast is covered, but the other is kind of covered by her arm and the baby. And the other one is being suckled on by the baby. So she's half naked, but covered. So, but she's still, you know, she's self-conscious. And he, in a very smooth move, we got to admit it, it's a very smooth move. He says, fair's fair. And he starts to strip slowly. And he gives her an eyeful. He asks her if she wants him to turn around and, take his trousers down with his back to her. She says, yes, please. And she sees the marks on his back. And then he says, it's from the Mohawk. Don't worry about it. He's like, he brushes it off. And then he slowly turns around and she's okay with it. And as he observes her nursing their child, she educates him on milk and how it comes out and how like speedy and like a squirt gun, they call it.
I swear, anytime anyone has a baby, we have to have this scene, the same scene. Some new person learning that boob milk squirts out with its own pressure system.
That's funny. He says that he wants, he's like, oh, Brie, I want you so. And he takes the sleeping babe, quote, for the first time, I've had a proper look at my son. Unquote. She tells him that she couldn't go back without him either. If that ever came to that, she wouldn't go back alone. And then she drops her robe or her shift, whatever it is. He says, what's holy is you, me, and us. Is there anything else? Eileen P. writes, I'm glad Roger chose to go with Jamie's advice and not be a coward. I think Brianna is scared enough. One of them needs to be brave to move this relationship forward. I love when Roger says this to Brianna. Roger's striptease reminds me of Jamie and Claire on their wedding night. I seem to remember Claire telling Jamie to take off his shirt. She wants to look at him. After Roger gets his breeches off, Brianna echoes Claire, quote, stay that way for a minute, she said. Please, I like to look at you, unquote. There is also an echo of pre-wedding Jamie and Claire when Brianna notices the scars on Roger's back given to him by the Mohawks. There's even a similar conversation between Roger and Brianna that Claire and Jenny had had about breastfeeding mechanics. That's what Summer said. Erica B. writes, a sweet gesture by Roger to strip down so Bree wouldn't feel so exposed while feeding the baby. This was a smart move, yeah, I think.
Once he explained it, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Because before the explanation came, it was just like, oh, you're going to feed the baby? Let me get naked.
Summer, that's just silly. That's silly.
Exactly. But having a small child and breastfeeding, there's so much like.
Not sexy.
Your brain is so frazzled. Well, it's not sexy.
That's what I said. It's not sexy.
And you just don't, you would hate for that to have been misinterpreted. You know what I mean? Where you're like, what are you doing? Because that's not what we're doing right now. I don't know what's going on. And plus, your brain works at a little different speed right after you've had a baby. Because, you know, you're tired. You're sleep deprived. You're focusing all of your time, attention, and everything on this baby. So it's like a lot of times those ideas don't even come into your head.
Erica B. continues, this was a smart move, I think, as to put both on the same playing field and also creating intimacy between the two in an otherwise vulnerable situation. That said, my husband never stripped down to make me more comfortable while nursing my wee bairns. Jealous. By the end, we know things.
Just ogled her, fully clothed.
By the end, we know things will be all right. They finally are comfortable with each other and the situation they're in. They both stayed for the same reasons. Love and obligation. And just simply for each other. And Lorraine B. writes, Throughout this chapter, we see Roger struggle to fit into family life, complete with a skittish wife and a large, overbearing Scott for a father-in-law. Acceptance on both accounts is something to be won over and not taken for granted. I like the fact that now Roger has made the decision to stay in the past, he won't give up. He gives Brianna time to get to know him again, but also asserts himself, following not only Jamie's advice, but his own heart. He tells Jamie to assign him some tasks and let it be known what he can't do, thus giving Jamie the opening to teach him. I also like the fact that Jamie gives Roger a chance to prove himself when he and Claire contrive a quiet night for Roger and his new family. In what could be a disastrous night, Diana cuts the tension by giving us one of those moments that sticks in my mind's eye, the sight of Roger stripping naked when he levels the playing field as Bree nurses their baby unhindered by clothing. We find out a lot about our Roger in these last couple of chapters. We gathered in Voyager that Roger was tenacious in his research abilities, a hard-working scholar who wasn't afraid of physical work on the fishing boat, and that he wasn't interested in a vapid dalliance with Brianna, but a serious relationship that ends in marriage. What we learn now is that despite many setbacks, he is still at his core tenacious, honorable, and hardworking. Jimmy tries not to hold a grudge over Ian's loss, also realizing the hardships he's caused Roger, and offers him an olive branch by acknowledging it. This is a good basis for a relationship that had a terrible start. All too easily, they could play tit for tat, bringing unwanted friction where their very ability to work together to survive would be compromised. Thank goodness Roger is wise enough to accept. I really love the intimate sharing depicted here that goes on between many new mothers and fathers. Roger is curious about breastfeeding, and as Bree shares what it's like for her, I feel sorry that Roger has missed out on the miracle of his sons.
He spent a week in the stone circles.
3 days.
That's why he missed it, however long. And now, moving along to a brief chapter called Domestic Bliss, chapter 68.
Leanne F. writes, Domestic. Origin, late Middle English from French domestique and Latin domesticus, from domus, house. Relating to the running of a home or to family relations. The word bliss, perfect happiness, great joy. It's Old English, blithes or bliss, of Germanic origin, related to blithe. This chapter allows us to see a morning on the ridge suffused with a, quote, general atmosphere of drowsy well-being. So unusual for the Frasers. This is a peaceful time without heartache or danger for once. We get to witness summertime contentment. Summertime and the living is easy. All is right with the Fraser world for this Halcyon. Oh, you're right. Halcyon. For this halcyon moment in time. It is August 1770. It's about a month and a half later than the last scenes in the last chapter, and the baby has finally slept through the night. The night before, Jamie had Claire look at the beautiful night, the vista, the view, and then he just stripped. And then she did the same. And then they walked out through the forest and probably did it a few times and slept outside.
The baby is a month and a however long old.
He was already
sleeping through the night.
He was already a month, and now it's been a month and a half more. So probably 2.5 months.
I know. But the thing to take away from this is that he's sleeping through the night, but he still doesn't have a name.
I know. That's crazy. Leanne F. writes, Then we learn that this is the morning after a magical night. Quote, It had been a perfect moon-drenched night. Claire thinks about her otherworldly experience of the previous night. I wouldn't have been surprised if the Frasers had encountered a fairy drenched in moonlight as they frolicked outside beneath the moon. There is again a sense of being out of time. They could be Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, naked beneath the moon once more. Their hearts are light and carefree as they celebrate the night and their blessings. They need nothing else but the moment and one another. They are intoxicated by the moonlight and love. Their perfect night together is remembered and treasured the following morning as a time of domestic bliss. Claire remembers and is nostalgic for the previous night's frolic as she plucks a stray leaf out of Jamie's hair, and Jamie responds with gentle touches, knowing glances, and kisses. Joe B. writes, Now it's August 1770. It's a welcome relief to be back on the ridge with familiar rhythms and routines, and with the question of Bree and Roger as good as answered, we come back to the heart of things. Jamie and Claire, as they restake their claim on their mountain in a season of beautifully described alfresco passion. I like that. So, the morning after. Oh, fun. Bree looks on like she knows what's up. She knows what's what. Leanne F. writes, Brianna is no longer embarrassed or feeling left out by witnessing her parents' domestic bliss. She and Roger are now in a good place as well, a place of well-being. Martina P. The breakfast scene the next morning with four sets of dreamy gazes indicates that magic happened the previous night on Fraser's Ridge. I'm such a sucker for Fraser's domestic bliss. And then Clarence is a Brayan. They have a visitor. It was Duncan MacLeod. I'm sorry, wrong series. Duncan McInnes Innes. Duncan Innes. Will they be going to the gathering at Mount Helicon that fall? They'd given their words two years earlier. Oh, by the way, in case it sweetens the deal, there'll be a priest there. But Duncan has more to say, too. So not only about the priest, he's like, look, you know, Jamie's like, I know, but we just got back. And then he's like, look, there's a priest. It's like, oh, and it's like, you know, you could have them christened. Oh, okay. And then Duncan puts, I wouldn't say adds more, you know, this is not adding more. This is just information. But the other reason he's there is he asks for Jamie's consent or blessing. I don't know which way, probably both, to marry Jamie's aunt, Jocasta. And Jamie like explodes in laughter. Quote, do you not think my aunt's of an age? Yes, exactly. Jamie assures him that he has no claim to his aunt's property. And he says, basically, for what it's worth, you don't need my permission, blessing, whatever. But for whatever it's worth, of course, go for it. Go with God. Martina P. writes, in this very short chapter, one could get the impression that Diana is winding down the story. I sometimes wonder if this book was originally thought to be the end of the Outlander saga. Granted, there are still some unresolved storylines with Ian, Leary, and so on. Oh, and a baby without a name, of course, as Summer said. To me, it always looked like Diana was setting the reader up for the ending. Well, we all know this is thankfully not the case, but I have sometimes wondered, although I had already downloaded The Fiery Cross to my iPad. Duncan Innes arrives and I cannot help but visualize Myrta on Fraser's Ridge, bearing the news that he is getting married to Jocasta. Huh. I don't think this is a spoiler, but mere speculation and wishful thinking on my part.
I would like to say that I always know that it's winding down because there's so few pages left in the book.
And the robot is literal, too.
Yeah, welcome.
Joe B. writes, into this peaceful morning after scene comes Duncan Innes. He and his news of impending wedding are welcome. How far has Duncan come up in the world? He could have had no thought to this when he agreed to stay at River Run. I don't think anyone thinks the marriage is based on a grand passion, but it gives Duncan well-earned status and position, and for Jocasta, the security of her home and of maintenance of her power. She trusts Duncan, won't remove her from her position, as another man might, and at least one other has tried. Of course, Joby mentions Lieutenant Wolf from Chapter 10. Duncan asking permission from Jocasta's nearest male relative is a sign of respect for both Jocasta and Jamie, as befitting family and tradition, but he is also seeking approval from the chief for himself. Claims him, Anfer Mekdu. Far or ar seems to mean better or well, but I'll happily be corrected, in acknowledgement of the status Jamie holds for Duncan, and to ensure that Jamie doesn't feel like Duncan has betrayed his trust. The influence and money of Jocasta is further shown by her ability to have a Catholic priest come to the gathering. Any man who wouldn't subscribe to Protestant doctrine was forbidden from office until 1835 in North Carolina. This is from Wikipedia, Catholic Church in the 13 Colonies. It will also allow Bree's baby to be christened properly, as well as Duncan's and Jocasta's wedding. I chose this chapter because at the time, no one else had it, and I was trying to challenge myself in writing about the less popular bits, so I was prepared to be less enthused by it. Not the case. This chapter, short as it is a turning point. Attending the gathering is more than fulfilling a promise. A social gathering and a chance to trade, as important as they are, it sets up the beginnings of the inhabitants of the ridge engaging in the wider world, and thus drives the story forward. This chapter is like the bridge in a piece of music. It references what had gone on before, in this case, Jamie and Claire, and the stability represented by the ridge, but leads to a new movement. What is the future for Roger and Bree, and how will Duncan and Jocasta's relationship influence things? In many ways, the next books hang on the changes begun in these 7 pages.
And now, the chapter you've all been waiting for. The baby gets a name. Chapter 69, entitled Jeremiah. I wonder what name they choose.
October 1770. They are taking...
Oh my God, it took that long?
It was August before.
Yeah, I know, but didn't she have the baby in like...
Oh, to name him?
May? Yes.
If he was a month-ish in the middle of June, then yes, he was born at least mid-May.
Golly.
If not a little earlier.
Oh my God.
So now it's 5 to 10. So now he's about 5 months old. And remember, this is Gizmo.
Sweet Jesus.
They're all taking the wagon into town. Of course, into town means towards River Run, or toward the gathering. They're all discussing the naming of Gizmo. Different names are thrown out, and they want to make sure Jamie is somehow represented with all of his 87 names. A number of people like the name Jeremiah. Quote, if Jeremiah seems too formal, you can call him Jemmy, unquote. Claire says, hey now. And, quote, Roger felt a small chill prickle down his spine at the sudden recollection of another child whose mother had called him Jemmy, a child whose father was fair-haired with eyes as green as Roger's own, unquote. Now, Roger goes up to Claire and mentions the time they came to see him in Inverness and she'd had his genealogy, the point where the substitution had been made, where Galus's child by Dougal was adopted into another who had a child who had died, William Buccleuch Mackenzie. He wants to know if she remembers the wife's name, because her name hadn't been listed on the tree. Claire, maybe not a Grange, but come on now. So I swear, these people are the most memory gifted people. Roger has, we get to later, a letter memorized. Claire has these family tree memorized. And Jamie, gosh, everything memorized. Oy.
I want to talk about that when we get to that chapter.
But she, yes. There's stuff to talk about. But she does remember the name. The name, of course, is Morag. And their son was named Jeremiah. Then Claire says that she'd asked Galus, like, oh, by the way, we're talking about names. And by the way, Galus, she'd asked Galus why they would be able to time travel. And she says it was to change things.
See,
Lorraine B.
Now I wonder.
Go ahead.
I wonder if that was if I misunderstood the question or if Galus misunderstood the question. Because.
I don't understand your question.
Okay. I'll tell you why. Because she says, I asked her why we are able to time travel. I'm expecting an answer like, genetics. It must be something in the blood. We must come from a long line of travelers. And her answer instead says, to change things. That doesn't explain why they travel.
She didn't say, okay. So there's two, just from what you just said, I took it two ways. So it's why can we travel? And then why can we travel?
Right.
It seems to me, if I understand correctly, that those are the two different readings or hearings that you had, or understandings that you had. And I only understood it or ever thought of it as, why does time travel exist at all? Like, why can people time travel? Even though she said we. So, yeah, but you know, that's interesting. I think it was a general question. I don't think it was specific to them. It just happens to be them doing the travel.
Okay.
But I think that's a good point. Lorraine B. writes, for Jamie, James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, James is his papal name, and the rest, I believe, are family names. It's only natural that Bree would want to honor her father by naming her firstborn after him in some way. I found it heartwarming that she would also want to honor Roger's father, even though she suspects that the child is not Roger's. I have included links that give us the meaning of Jamie's and Jeremiah's names. As we find out, not only is Jeremiah Roger's father's name, but it's the name of his 7th cousin, and Roger has met him, his father, and mother on the Gloriana when he made the trip with the infamous Captain Bonnet to the colonies and save the poor kid's life with a fortuitous toss of a coin. I love the way Diana weaves coincidences into the story. What do we call those, Summer?
Granges.
Family is very important, and I wonder if we will see them again, since we have already met them back with Bonnet. I've also included a way to figure out genealogy relationships. I hope I got Jeremiah's right. Then we will share these links in the show notes.
I thought about it when he was talking about saving Morag's baby. And I had a lot of thoughts, because a lot of times I when I think about the time travel, it's like, well, what if they've always traveled? So that's why nothing changes. So, and if that's the case, then he always traveled. So he always saved Morag's baby. So there was always the possibility or the guarantee that he's born later. But then I was like, but not necessarily, because do they know for sure that Jeremiah is the line from Morag that leads directly to him?
Well, it's not about Morag. It's about the father.
Right. But Morag is the wife of the father. So he has to have babies with Morag. And it could be, I'm sure there's more than one baby, because there's no birth control.
Yes, but other babies wouldn't be Mackenzie's.
Yes, they would be.
Well, okay. They're Mackenzie's, right? Because they're part of that clan. So they might be Mackenzie's by name, but they wouldn't be Dougal's get.
They're still from Buccleuch, whatever, right?
Oh, wait. So William... Got it. So William is the changeling replacement, correct?
Her husband, Morag's husband.
Yeah, that's William. Yes. Okay, got it. So I keep thinking about the baby. I see what you're saying. So you're saying is, how do we know the baby he saved is the one who is the direct line?
Correct.
I think that we may not know, or we definitely don't know right now. Well, we know only because Diana... We all assume it, right? And Roger assumes it, and Diana wants us to assume it.
Okay, so if we assume it, then we have two outcomes that could have happened. A, the baby never died, or the baby didn't really need saving.
Well, and it gets even more interesting. A few chapters ago, when Jamie et al. Went to rescue Roger from the Mohawk, one of the reasons he says he brought Claire is because they know their death date. And it's practical mortality. So you could almost use the same excuse, right? If he knows he's going to be born in 1940, whatever, if he goes back, the mere fact that he was born and aged up till the 60s to be able to go back, he could use that as practical mortality. It's not the same. I know that. But you know what I'm trying to say?
Mm.
Ish?
Ish. Anyway, I took you on a digression. All right. And now on to chapter 70, entitled The Gathering.
So the last gathering that Claire had seen was at Castle Leach. That's the last gathering we'd all seen in Outlander.
Nuh-uh. Didn't we see one at the Highland Gathering, that the folk thing that Roger went to?
I mean, that's a modern... Come on. There's like not really a comparison.
Okay, fine.
You can call it that. I'm not going to say it's not like the modern day equivalent. At the gathering... Claire recalls the last gathering at Castle Leach more than 30 years ago. Although there will be no more events like these back in Scotland, a home almost lost forever for so many of the Scots here in North Carolina, Claire paints a beautiful picture of her surroundings, the sights, the emotions, and the Scottish clan members gathered here to celebrate their traditions in the New World. This almost moves me to tears how these families who lost everything in Scotland find a new life and community here and preserve their history and their culture. Erica B. writes, I bet the gathering feels like a giant family reunion, seeing faces you both know and don't know. But either way, there is an unwritten kinship among everyone there. So, first, or one of the awesome things, is they run into John Quincy Myers, Summer's favorite triple bald dude. He's there to sell his hides. And he tells them about where he's been, and he says, yeah, I've been far north, and I've been up the Mohawk River. And yes, indeed, he had even seen young Ian. He even had a package, small package from young Ian, that had a letter with it. And he gives that to Claire. Now, Jamie is gone, but once he returns, shortly thereafter, they read it together. Ian begins in Latin, And Jamie, of course, is like bawling on him. Ian says that he is well. He is married. And of course, it's to Emily. Rollo is a puppy daddy many times over. And he and Emily are pregnant. And he'll send word.
Like many times? Does that mean that he's just getting all the dogs, all the female dogs in the village pregnant? Or...
Well, not just that, but also each dog probably has a litter of 5 to 8 pups.
Yeah, but he's like he was a dad many times over. I'm imagining he's just like litter after litter after litter. And he's not been gone that long. And puppies do have gestation periods. It's not like rabbits.
If he helps make one litter of puppies and there's like 10 in there or 5 in there or whatever, he's a dad 5 times over. That's not once.
I know, but the way that it was written, it made it sound like he's been prolifically.
He just was everywhere.
Breeding.
Well, I mean, I don't know. And he says he'll send word of the birth in the spring. Martina P. writes, how delightful to have John Quincy Myers visiting again. Claire is so utterly happy that he is delivering news and a letter from beloved Ian. Don't we all miss Ian and Rollo? Despite the heartbreak, Ian seems to be happy with a wife and a baby on the way. Jamie's heart must have been very heavy reading Ian's letter. However, he ends a very emotional moment with humor, as only Jamie can, by correcting Ian's attempt and closing with a Latin sentence to the correct grammar. Erica B. writes, it's amazing mails that gets to its actual destination with the way folks just carry it with each other's mail. Everyone carrying everything else around. On day 2 of the gathering, Jamie surprises Lizzie with her dad. And also, he's torn up Mr. Weems' indenture, and he will burn it later that night.
In case somebody finds it and tapes it back together?
I guess. Erica B. says, can we say grange? Tie that storyline up with a nice little bow.
I can say grange.
Sure you can. By day 3, Claire is full of gossip and news. Roger was having a great time with all the singing, and Jamie takes Gizmo to go gamble. Claire, of course, is doing her doctoring. Erica B. writes, finally, some poison ivy is in the new world. Surprised there hasn't been more. Also, I'm curious what the treatment was and if Claire taught them what it looked like. Then, okay, something I'm going to say before I announce what this thing is. When something like this happens, especially, oh my gosh, at the end of a book, like we're literally 4, 8, 10, whatever pages from the end of the book, and something like this happens, especially if it's Diana, if nothing else, this alone should have told you that it's not a final book of any kind. What happens next? A Highland regiment arrives, 40 strong. Their leader comes up to Jamie. Now, a lot of people are wondering, there's like 200 or so Scots there, and then there's 40 members of this Highland, 40 soldiers. Now, what they don't know, even though they're Scots, they don't know if they're there as friends or foe, if they're there as military or as Scotsmen, like, you know, who happen to be military. Their leader comes up to Jamie, and he is one Archie Hayes. Quote, they say you can't my feather, unquote. Of course, if you don't remember, or if you do remember, that's Gavin Hayes, the one who was hanged at the beginning of Drums of Autumn. Martina P. writes, as Roger is singing and having a good time, I always think that it is such a shame that Jamie is unable to fully appreciate Roger's talent. Instead, he needs to ask Claire if he's any good. Although I'm sure he is observing the positive reactions from listeners gathered around Roger. It is only appropriate that Jamie is so fond of his grandson, taking care of him by taking him along to find a card game to teach him a proper trade in case he is unable to earn his supper with singing. I adore Jamie's sense of humor and his emotional intelligence. Wherever he goes, he is well regarded. Everybody is looking to him for advice and help. A natural-born leader who is respected by all. And finally, Erica B. writes, hopefully he doesn't want anything bad, this is regarding Archie Hayes, and hopefully just wants to thank him. But I mean, how disconcerting for the gathering to have this regiment show up. I would have been freaked out if it were me. Me too, Erica.
They were also freaked out.
Yes, you don't need to bring 40 men with you to say, you knew my dad, thank you. You don't need it. You do not need a regiment to say thank you to someone. Nope.
I mean, it's also a gathering. Mm-hmm. All the Scottish people are gathering.
That's true.
So maybe they wanted to also join in at the gathering. And finally, we will complete our Drums of Autumn read-along by discussing chapter 71, aptly titled Circles Close.
Lisa T. writes, the title is fascinating. It literally means the close of a circle, which is improbable as circles have no beginning or end. The title could also have been Circles Close, as in several circles closing, which in fact does happen in this chapter. It is also a reference to a stone circle, and in yet another twist, it could refer to rings, which are circular. So many circles, but the title refers to one circle in particular, Frank's. Roger comes to Jamie to pass on a message. When Brianna went through the stones, he'd had to wait a few weeks before he could go. He spent some time in Inverness at his father's and going through some of his papers. While he was there, he found a letter from Frank to the Reverend, and he committed it to memory. So not knowing if he should share it with Claire or Bree, he shares first with Jamie.
This is the longest letter I think anyone in the history of anything has ever memorized.
Oh gosh, it's a lot.
Like, can we just take a moment and appreciate Roger's memory? Because that is an insanely long letter to remember verbatim, word for word. And he says he did, so I'm taking him at his word that these are all the words from the letter. But that is impressive.
So he shares with Jamie first. Now in the letter, Frank has something, we find out that Frank actually has something physically wrong with him. He's got something wrong with his heart. The doctor says it might be years before anything happens, or it might not be. We also learn that Frank has asked the Reverend to place the gravestone at St. Kilda's, next to or near Jonathan Wolverton Randall's grave. Quote, if she cares to look further, well, that's as far as I'm prepared to go. I've made the gesture. I shall leave it to chance what happens when I've gone. Unquote. He'd gone to Cray na Dun again. And through history, through his studies, through his research, he had searched for Jamie Fraser. And he'd found him. Or at least someone of that name. We also learn that Frank hated Jamie. He'd kept that a secret, though. Quote, and yet, I have the oddest sense of James Fraser, almost a memory, as though I must have seen him somewhere. Unquote. He also admits to treating Claire badly. Quote, I treated Claire badly, or well, depending on how one looks at it. Unquote. But he loves them, Claire and Brianna. If Frank had chosen to keep secret what he'd found and that stone had not been placed at St. Kilda's, would Claire have given the truth? Would Claire have learned the truth anyway? Well, think about that. That's a nice change in the show for you. Real quick, in the show, they don't even ever visit the cemetery. It's all through research, right, Sam?
I thought she found the stone.
In the show?
How else did she come across it? I don't remember. Oh, she went on her own and found that, the deed of Sassine, right?
Yeah.
So she was doing the hunting on her own.
So it's just interesting that there may or may not, I think there has to be some, they've already started the whole letter writing thing. So thank God they kept that, because wow. But this letter or something like it, obviously, it can't be the exact same letter because there was no gravestone in the show. But yeah, actually, they changed a lot of this by not having him place it. Well, not even the placement only, but by not having him place it and thus not having this kind of letter, confession letter, we don't learn how much he hates Jamie.
There may be this confession letter,
but it can't be. Well, okay, there may be a letter that says that, but it won't say that I put the stone there.
No, but he could do all the other things. Also, I would like to call into question the wisdom of Roger not just telling everyone about this letter at one time. because he's going to finish telling Jamie and Jamie's going to say, yeah, you should tell him. And then he has to go and recite this 40 page long letter all over again.
Oh, gosh, that's funny. Well, we learn that Morag and her husband were not at the gathering. I don't know if that's, it's not, I don't think that's necessarily important at this moment. The book's almost done. It's not important right now, but it's an interesting observation. And he's decided that now that he's told Jamie, he definitely will tell Bree. Lisa T writes, he doesn't mention it, but I wonder if he found the newspaper clipping about the fire. We do know that Frank saw Jamie's ghost in the beginning of Outlander. The next morning, the next part of the letter is a reverse parallel to Jamie's farewell speech to Claire in Dragonfly and Amber. Quote, so there it is, Reg. Hate, jealousy, lying, stealing, unfaithfulness, the lot. Not much to balance it, save love. I do love her. Love them, my women. Maybe it's not the right kind of love or not enough, but it's all I've got. Unquote. This is Frank's version of a farewell. Here is Jamie's from Dragonfly. Quote, I will find you, he whispered in my ear. I promise. Oof, it's going to give me a tear prick. If I must endure 200 years of purgatory, 200 years without you, then that is my punishment which I have earned for my crimes. For I have lied and killed and stolen, betrayed and broken trust. But there is one thing that shall lie in the balance. When I shall stand before God, I shall have one thing to say, to weigh against the rest. Lord, you gave me a rare woman, and God, I loved her well. Unquote. A little later, Jamie says, quote, Frank, well, I leave it to you what you shall tell him about me. Likely he'll not want to hear. Tell him I'm grateful. Tell him I trust him. And tell him I hate him to his guts and the marrow of his bones. Unquote. By the chapter's end, we see that Jamie is finally able to accept Frank as being a part of Claire and Bree's life. By giving Claire Frank's ring, Jamie closes Frank's circle by giving him back to Claire and wishing him peace. The ring is still warm from Jamie's body, as though he had been keeping it alive for Claire. Frank is part of Claire and always will be. Jamie puts aside his hatred of Frank for Claire and Bree's sake. Megan P. writes, no matter how many times I read the letter excerpt, I'm still confused. Did he commission the Reverend to leave the stone in that place in an effort to reunite or keep them apart? And if the tombstone is fake, will Claire freak out? After all, she is under the impression that Jamie will die in Scotland. He still might, but now there's no certainty. That's a good question. Okay, Summer, how do you answer Megan?
I mean, I don't know why.
Well, no. The first question is, did he commission the Reverend to leave the stone in an effort to reunite or keep them apart?
And I don't know why. The thing is... It couldn't have been to keep them apart. And the reasoning is because she never went back to Scotland after they left. And it wasn't until after Frank was gone that she started looking again, which was the promise she made to him, correct?
Her promise, well, okay, book or show. In the show, she promised not to say anything. In the book, okay, maybe it's the same. I don't think she promised not to look for him. I think she promised not to say anything to Brianna. And listeners, please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm very, very happy to be corrected, because I don't want to get this wrong. But I believe in the books, she agreed that she would not say anything to Brianna about her time in Scotland, about Jamie, about any of that, as long as Frank was alive.
They're not going to answer you right now.
I know. Dork. Okay, so it could, well, yeah, I think, honestly, it's not necessarily in an effort to reunite them. Like he said, it was an olive branch, or like Lisa T wrote, I think it was an olive branch, if nothing else. Because without her reading the letter, she'll have no clue that Frank was the one who placed it there. Unless, she doesn't have a reason to think it's fake. To go trying to find out at which year this tombstone was added. You know what I mean? From having zero knowledge to seeing it, there's no reason. There's no reason for her to think it's fake. So that would not enter her mind. What would enter her mind is seeing his stone so close to Randall's. Oh my gosh, he died at, well, maybe the date. I don't know. Maybe like the date was hard to see or whatever. But seeing that he died. Okay, I guess there she couldn't have thought he died at Culloden, right? Because if she thought he died at Culloden from seeing the stone, she wouldn't have started her research. She just saw it. She saw there and she couldn't see dates on it. And so she wanted to find out what happened to him. Is that right?
I'm looking it up right now.
Oh, the in Dragonfly?
Yes. I promised Frank, I said, 20 years ago when you were born, I tried to leave him and he wouldn't let me go. He loved you. He couldn't believe the truth, but he knew, of course, that he wasn't your father. He asked me not to tell you, to let him be your only father as long as he lived. After that, he said it was up to me.
Okay. That's what I thought. So she's promised as long as he was alive, but not to not research. She promised not to tell her about it.
Yeah, I don't know that that wasn't the promise, but I know that she didn't look because she didn't have the heart to look.
Oh, yeah, that's why she didn't look. But I don't think she didn't look slash research because of the promise. The promise was I won't tell Brianna about this while you're alive. I won't mention she won't know anything other than you are her dad. So to answer your question, Megan, we both believe that he put the fake tombstone there as a in Frank's own words from Roger's memorized letter, as an olive branch, or that may have been from Lisa T, but as an olive branch. And also it was to potentially reunite them. And I don't think we understand how it could go further to keep them apart. They're already 200 years apart. I mean, you can't get more apart than that.
Well, and that's the thing. He's already dead. He doesn't get less dead by the placing of a stone or more dead by the placing of a stone. And the stone he left literally only left more questions because it didn't have a death date. It didn't have a birth date. It was literally just his name. So if nothing else, it was a conversation starter
or a research trip starter. By the fourth day of the gathering, the crowds had grown. Quote, the mountainside was alive with fires and, quote, a dozen families had declared themselves. Unquote. And then Jamie's voice rings out. The Frasers of the Ridge are here. As Jamie and Claire relax later that evening, he says goodbye to the ghost of Frank. And he tells him, go in peace. Roger puts Jamie's ruby ring on Brianna's finger. She has chosen. She tells Roger, quote, go down and tell them the Mackenzies are here, unquote. Megan P. writes, I love this last part of the chapter. The description of the gathering and the family unity shown by all is so special. The historical times, strong cultures, and traditions are so interesting to me. As someone who has Scottish heritage, I just picture my ancestors at gatherings in the past, and it gives me chill bumps to think about how rich my family history must be.
And that was Drums of Autumn, people.
Oh, my goodness. In 1 week, we hope you will be hearing. Well, in 1 week from the day this is published, you will be able to see Outlander on television. That's for show. We hope that our episode will be going up that night. You never know what things happen, but it will be up within very close. But we're hopeful, and yeah, we're hopeful. But yeah, definitely Outlander comes back. Woo.
It does. And be sure to join our Facebook group at www.outlanderpod.com/group and join us for our live after show that we do every week after the show airs on the East Coast.
Yes. And we will we might do the first one in the group. We'll definitely announce it before we go live. We're not going to leave you hanging. Join our group no matter what. We would love to have you there. I'd love to welcome you there. But I think we're going to try and see if we can do the split screen to do the live after show on the Facebook page so we can reach more people. But at the very least, we know that the group is a safe bet. So there's always that. So thank you guys for joining us on this episode. Thank you guys for joining us. Those of you who are troopers and have listened to many, most, or even all of our discussions about each chapter. Summer, we did 71. Holy crap. Summer, just for shiggles, can you check out Fiery Cross and just see how many chapters? I'm afraid to look.
I happen
don't
to
look
have
at
it
pages,
right here.
Just chapters. I don't want to think about
I'm
pages.
Not intending. I mean, Ginger, the chapters are on the pages.
I'm saying, I'm telling, don't tell me how many
pages. I know.
Page
I'm being.
Don't be that way.
I am that way. 110.
Shut up.
No, I'm sorry. 111.
So,
and I know you're not asking, but it's 979 pages.
So you all have an idea what we're looking at in next spring. So thank you guys so much for sticking with us and joining us. Those of you who have joined us just for our Drums of Autumn read along, or and those of you who have been along with us since episode one of our Outlander read along. This has definitely grown to be an experience. What was a hobby is now a more expensive and more time consuming hobby, but still a lot of fun. We've met so many people and made so many amazing friends, not just through our show and through the fandom in general, but specifically, you know, people we travel internationally with now. It's really crazy. You could not have surprised me more. I never would have guessed this, you know, all the stuff we've been able to do and the people we've been able to meet friends wise and of course connections with the show, whatever it may be, back in June, July of 2013 when the show was first announced and Sam was oopsie casted. So as Summer said, we are looking forward to the next, but before then we've got so much goodness coming your way. Surely we will have some interviews, some giveaways, and most importantly, we hope you join us for season 4 of Stars Outlander. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode, in which we'll be discussing episode 401, America the Beautiful. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code Outlander20, Outlander20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Outlander Pod.